Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 1300 GMT on Tuesday the 9th of July, these are our main stories. Ukraine is in mourning after one of the worst days of attacks in the war, with a children's cancer hospital targeted in Kyiv. We examine conflicting claims about who fired the missiles that hit the hospital. School students in South Korea have to receive suicide prevention education to tackle high suicide rates among young Koreans. Also in this podcast, outrage in China over reports that fuel tankers carrying toxic chemicals are also transporting cooking oil. And more attacks on gay people in Ghana ahead of a new law.
You're driving home, then you feel you are being followed. You go to the mall and then you have to make sure you work with someone as a security.
We start with Ukraine, a country in mourning after yesterday's missile attack on a children's cancer hospital, one of the worst days of the war, according to the mayor of Kyiv. The pictures of doctors digging for survivors with their bare hands and bald-headed children running from the building holding their drips as they tried to escape were shocking and haunting. 38 people were killed and 166 injured as missiles hit many towns across the country. Moscow has denied targeting the children's hospital in Kyiv. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova said that it was a NASAMS surface-to-air missile launched by Ukraine that hit the hospital. For more on Russia's perspective, James Copnell has been speaking to Vitaly Milonov, a member of the Russian State Duma.
Actually, I've seen what's happened in Kyiv, and our guys were brilliant in direct targeting and hitting the military objects.
Have you seen the footage of the hospital, which has been almost totally destroyed?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen the picture, and I'm also a member of Russian army right now, and I've seen a lot of signs that the hospital being hit by anti-missile, and actually what's been done by Ukrainians is that they cannot use anti-missile weapons. Russian missile can hit any building, totally destroying this building. So it's not been hit by Russian very powerful missile. It's when they're trying to hit Russian missiles that are, and as a result, these missiles make a lot of damage to civilian building.
Again, the Ukrainians have presented fragments of a Russian missile on the site. You talk about a Russian missile would have done more damage, and yet huge amounts of that building, there are pictures on the BBC website if people want to go and see, images too, huge destruction done to that building. This can't be a proud day for you, can it, as a member of the Russian military, to see a children's hospital destroyed in this way?
Of course, I know that today you have a forthcoming NATO meeting and you have to provide more information, more terrifying information to ask for more money from the European taxpayers. Actually, the only way is to end this war and to establish peace and security in Europe is not to provide your weapon to Ukrainians. You know that in any case, we're going to win this war.
Vitaly Milonov from the Russian State Duma. But Ukraine says it has found remnants of a Russian cruise missile. So let's analyse the claims with Merlin Thomas of BBC Verify.
So we've been looking at two specific videos that show a missile landing into Kyiv moments before impact. And so it's quite rare because daytime attacks are quite rare, and that means that you actually get to see the missile in this video. And what we've done is we've slowed this video right down and zoomed in, and you can see the missile quite clearly. So we showed five munitions experts this video, and they all kind of unanimously agree that this is not a surface-to-air defense missile as the Russians have claimed. And the reason for that is there are quite telltale signs when you watch the video, especially for experts. So what they told us is it's because of the missile speed, the angle of the attack. You can see it kind of jutting down onto the Capitol, as well as the profile. So if you're kind of a weapons expert nerd, you can kind of think about the box at the bottom of a cylinder as the missile comes in. That is quite a telltale sign that it is in line, actually, with what Ukraine have been claiming, that this is a land attack cruise missile, as one of our munitions experts said. As well as that, you can also hear, when you listen to the video, you can hear a kind of whistling sound. And one of our weapons experts, Timothy Wright from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, actually said that that sound of a high-pitched kind of turbofan is very prominent, and it's a dead giveaway. That's what he said. But when we kind of go about looking into these videos, it can be tricky because there are claims and counterclaims, and you have to remember that this is something that Russia do all the time. They make these kinds of claims.
So I was going to say, in the past, have both sides made false claims?
Russia makes these claims frequently. This isn't the first time that they've said that Ukraine has been responsible for striking its own cities. But experts we spoke to have unanimously agreed that it's not a Ukrainian weapon as claimed by the Russians. And that's what we can say so far.
Merlin Thomas from BBC Verify. According to the World Health Organization, suicide is the fourth biggest cause of death among the 15 to 29 age group around the world. In South Korea, it's the leading cause of death from 9 to 24-year-olds. The country's education system is known for its high pressure and hyper-competitiveness, but the long hours and intense competition have contributed to mental health problems. From Friday, all state school students must attend classes on suicide prevention. Jae-sung Lee told me more.
Firstly, let me give you a broader picture in South Korea. South Korea has the highest suicide rate in East Asia and the highest among the world's developed nations. Zooming in on this particular issue, it's particularly serious for young people aged between 9 to 24, as you mentioned earlier, Rachel, with suicide being by far the largest cause of death for this age group. Now, a recent government report showed a quarter of middle and high school students suffer from depression, which is a major cause of suicides. And that's partly to do with the fact that South Korea's education system, as you said, is notorious for its long hours of studying and tough competition. There's this constant pressure to achieve high grades so that you get into the top universities, and you're constantly compared to other students by your parents. There's a word in Korean I just want to tell you. It's roughly translated into the son or daughter of my mother's friends. It's a word that's been popularized in recent years to denote someone's son or daughter who's very successful that your mother constantly raves about and talks about. And it's a major headache for those who are less successful because, you know, you feel ashamed, embarrassed, or just simply annoyed by the constant comparison. And that whole comparison culture that South Korea has and the pressure that comes with it is just too much for many to cope with.
So it's a cultural issue, something is going to be very difficult to combat. But this program in these classes, what do they do?
Well, they mainly comprise of two parts. The first is more of a theoretical one that aims to educate students on the act of suicide itself. This includes lessons of factors that contribute to the decline in mental health and ways to manage such conditions. The second part is more focused on practical elements, such as guidance of supporting students exposed to high risk of suicide and teaching them how to recognize such warning signs and take necessary measures to prevent them from taking their own lives.
Jae-sung Lee. Chinese hackers working for the government are repeatedly targeting official and private sector networks in Australia and across the Asia-Pacific region. That's the accusation from Australia's Cyber Intelligence Agency today. It's pointing the finger at a group called APT40, or Advanced Persistent Threat, which it says works with the help of China's Ministry of State Security. So how significant is it that Canberra is making such a direct accusation against Beijing? Catherine Masted is executive director of an Australian cybersecurity consultancy. She's been speaking to James Menendez.
This is the first time Australia has led on one of these multilateral attributions. Normally, it is the US government in the driving seat, and it is the Australian government today. And we've seen not just the usual Anglosphere of the Five Eyes countries joining this statement of the UK, Australia, the US, New Zealand and Canada, but also some non-traditional democracies as well in South Korea, Japan and Germany. So an increasingly broad-based group of countries here really drawing a line in the sand and saying what they think is not acceptable in cyberspace.
And why do you think Australia is doing this? Is it a sign of growing confidence that Australia has the clout to call this out, or is it just fed up of all this hacking going on?
You're right. I think the tempo of what a lot of different democracies are seeing from China and other authoritarian governments in this space is really increasing. So partly there's a lot more of the malicious activity happening. I think also there is less tolerance for activity that targets businesses, the private sector, democratic institutions when it comes to espionage as well. And again, Australia's not alone here. New Zealand, for the first time ever, a couple of months ago, pointed the finger to the same Chinese hacking group. The other part is it's not just Australia here talking to China. It's actually, I would say, Australia talking to like-minded partners to say, hey, we are all agreeing on what some of the norms in cyberspace are. And also Australia talking to its own citizens and businesses, because it's those businesses and citizens that actually can do the most here to keep Australia's defences up, because most of our industry is, of course, in private hands. A lot of this targeting is across the economy. So it's about sharing information about this threat so that those outside of government can do something about it as well.
The Chinese government, through the Chinese embassy in Canberra, has said that China does not encourage, support or condone attacks launched by hackers. I mean, is that credible? This group APT40, is there no doubt that it is part of the Chinese government, the Ministry of State Security?
And it's not just Western liberal democracies saying that. A couple of months ago, Microsoft said that it had seen this group, APT40, hacking across more or less every country in the South Pacific in the last year. So I think, look, it's very expected. We hear this from China all the time when governments point the finger at China. Invariably, they come back and say, look, it's not us. Reasonable readers and viewers of these types of statements will draw their own conclusions about the veracity of those claims.
People listening will also probably be thinking, well, hold on, aren't Australia and its allies almost certainly doing the same sort of thing to Chinese public and private companies?
Yeah, look, it's a fair question. And it's also fair to say almost every government in the world does some kind of espionage. I think what's different here is a couple of things. One is the scale and ubiquity of APT40, this Chinese hacking group, but also the uses that intelligence is put to. The Ministry of State Security is, of course, China's internal secret police. And it's also known not just for trying to understand matters of state, but sometimes and increasingly quite ubiquitously targeting dissidents, diaspora groups, those who threaten the political security of the Chinese Communist Party. It's also known for commercial intelligence, stealing IP. Some would say China is responsible for the greatest transfer of wealth in history in terms of what has been a lot of this group, APT40's role in economic espionage. And that's, I think, where a lot of democratic countries are now drawing a line and saying this type of activity, we don't think, is acceptable.
Catherine Mustard talking to James Menendez. A food scandal has hit China following reports on social media that fuel tanker trucks are being used to transport cooking oil and other food products. Chinese officials have now launched what they call a major investigation. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports.
People in China have been expressing shock on social media after discovering that there are no regulations here preventing tankers, which are carrying toxic coal oil one day, from then transporting cooking oil or other food products the next. Not only are the lorries allowed to do this, but according to reports on local state-run media, this is exactly what they've been doing, and without properly cleaning the tankers in between. The practice is said to have been so widespread that it's been considered an open secret in the industry, according to one driver quoted in the Beijing News. Sinograin, a massive government-operated grain stockpiler, has announced an internal inquiry into its own operations, and both the Hebei and Tianjin provincial governments say they're also looking into the matter. However, this follows a long line of food security scandals in China, which have led to considerable public mistrust in the capability of officials to ensure that the country's produce is safe to consume. The China's tankers have been carrying food products straight after they've transported toxic materials containing sulfides, benzene and various hydrocarbons has yet again eroded public confidence in food quality. And it'll take a lot for this to be rebuilt.
Stephen McDonnell. Coming up, we'll bring you a report from Australia where foreigners with disabilities are often denied a residency visa.
We're saying, not implicitly but directly, to people living with disability in this country, you are not welcome here. Given the opportunity, we would rather not have you.
As you record the pod, world leaders from NATO's 32 member countries are gathered in Washington for a summit to mark the alliance's 75th anniversary. President Zelensky is also there. Ukraine was already top of the agenda, and NATO's leaders have condemned Monday's missile attacks. But how far can they go in their support? Kiev's immediate hopes for membership of the organisation seem likely to be dashed again, as our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports.
Well, I'm standing next to the blast barriers and the iron security fencing and security cameras of the Russian embassy here in Washington, D.C. Definitely not invited to the NATO summit, but we've come here because of what's on the other side of the street. And from all four homes facing the Russian embassy, they're hanging Ukrainian flags.
Across town, world leaders are arriving to celebrate an alliance whose basis is a one-for-all and all-for-one pledge to defend each other against attacks. Ukraine wants into NATO. But despite this 75th anniversary summit for an alliance forged in the ashes of destruction from the Second World War, there will be no NATO birthday present for President Zelensky.
We need a bigger room. Well, Mr. President, welcome. And I hope
that was last year's summit, a Biden-Zelensky meeting, where the US president resisted Ukraine's calls to enter NATO quickly. He fears escalation with Russia if that were to happen soon. Now, NATO is offering what the US calls a bridge to membership, a short one, it says. But still, Mr. Zelensky may have to hide the disappointment he showed more clearly last time. Today, some Biden supporters see this approach as too risk-sensitive and call for clearer NATO pledges for Kyiv, like Evelyn Farkas, who ran Russia and Ukraine policy at the Pentagon under President Obama.
I mean, if Vladimir Putin is made to understand that the territory that Ukraine now has control over, that if Russia takes one step into those territories, that NATO would come to Ukraine's defense. I think if we communicated that clearly to Putin, he would understand that he does not want war with NATO.
Quite a gamble, though, is a potential move.
It is a gamble, but I do think we should do everything we can to accelerate admitting Ukraine into NATO.
Instead of membership, at the end of this summit, there are likely to be pledges to Ukraine to coordinate aid through NATO, possibly via a new mission in Germany, alongside a series of one-on-one security pacts countries have been making with Kyiv, including the US. But many in the room are worried all this can't be made Trump-proof.
NATO was busted until I came along. I said, everybody's going to pay. They said, well, if we don't pay, are you still going to protect us? I said, absolutely not. They couldn't believe the answer.
One of several comments made by the former president to the horror of NATO supporters. Earlier this year, the EU commissioner, Thierry Breton, recounted a story of a meeting in 2020 with Mr. Trump and the EU chief, Ursula von der Leyen.
And Donald Trump said to Ursula, you need to understand that if Europe is under attack, we will never come to help you and to support you. And by the way, NATO is dead. And we will leave. We will quit NATO. It was the President of the United States of America. He may come back.
Donald Trump took credit for his erratic approach as president, boosting NATO countries' defense spending, although most increases have come since due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Dan Caldwell from the right-wing think tank Defense Priorities says a second Trump term would add to the pressure on the alliance.
I don't think he wants to withdraw from NATO, but he has said that the United States should reevaluate its role and the purpose of NATO going forward. In particular, I think that he and others around him think that the Europeans need to bear more of the financial burden in funding NATO, and also I think bear more of the burden in actually securing Europe as a whole.
As the NATO anthem plays in Washington, European countries know they have to put more into their own defences to keep the guarantee of US protection. Few in Europe want to pay the price of being outside NATO now, but the costs of membership are going up.
Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Human rights organisations are warning that gay people in Ghana are experiencing an increase in attacks directed at them since the country's parliament passed a tough new anti-LGBT bill earlier this year. The president hasn't yet signed it into law as it's been challenged at the country's Supreme Court. Gay sex is already punishable with up to 3 years in jail. Under the law, people convicted of identifying as LGBT could get the same punishment. It would also affect people around them, ban any organisation advocating for their rights, a media organisation accused of promoting an LGBT lifestyle. Mac Darling Cobbiner is an LGBT activist in Ghana. He says homophobes are being emboldened by the prospective law and shared what life looks like for him now as an openly gay man.
You're driving home, then you feel you are being followed. You go to the mall and then you have to make sure you walk with someone as a security protection, or you are at a restaurant, some people walk there and then they try to humiliate you. And when they attack you there, they are safe.
Amnesty International says many are too afraid to report attacks to the police, but that their data is showing an increase of violence, attacks, provocations, blackmail, extortion and forced evictions of LGBT people. Genevieve Partington is the organisation's country director for Ghana. She's called the bill draconian and urged the president not to sign it.
Extortion has really been on the rise. It's extremely disturbing what is going on. And if anyone says there are no increased cases of violence, then I believe they don't have their facts.
Sam George is the Ghanaian MP who introduced the anti-LGBT legislation into Parliament. He spoke to my colleague Ed Butler and began by explaining why he wanted to tighten the law further.
We're very conservative people. We are not interested in what people do in the privacy of their bedrooms. But when they want to make their private matters issues of public advocacy, then the public gets very riled up. And so I indicated that I was going to bring in legislation that was going to tighten Ghana's family values and anti-homosexuality legislation, which is what I've done.
This new law criminalises what was already criminal, gay love, and it also potentially forces people who are even relatives and friends of people who might be gay to report on them, to snitch on them.
That's actually not correct. The provision you're speaking about is titled the duty to report and prohibition of extrajudicial treatment. So it says that anybody who has knowledge of the commission of an offence has a duty to report it and not to carry out extrajudicial treatment, which is something that the LGBTQ community themselves have complained about, and which is something I agree, that no matter the offence anybody commits in Ghana, they have the right to a fair trial, and that mob justice must not be meted out to them.
Well, what they're saying to us, what people are saying to us is that not only did these attacks against gay people happen before, but now that this law has been introduced and all the publicity attached to it, it hasn't been obviously signed by the president, but now this law has been passed through Parliament, there's now a massive increase in the amount of attacks on gay people, specific blackmail threats, violence against them. Life is becoming harder and more intolerable.
Well, this is the BBC we're talking, I'm talking to. I mean, I expect that the BBC verify whatever information is brought to you.
I am just reporting what's being reported to me.
Yeah, but if there is any evidence of increased violence, you will have reports of that in police reports. Absolutely no such things exist here.
Amnesty International is saying the same thing. Amnesty International is saying the same thing.
The fact that Amnesty International is saying that doesn't mean that it is verified. I live in Ghana. I can dare anybody to show you an increased number of attacks on homosexuals in Ghana. There is no such evidence. Look, between January and March, and I haven't checked the latest figures, there's been no murder in Ghana over homosexuality, and not because of this legislation. So you need to begin to interrogate these things and not just swallow line, hook, and sinker people who realize that the West has overly become woke and are trying to drive you down a cul-de-sac. I am challenging any media house, I'm challenging anybody to show evidence of attacks against homosexuals in Ghana on the increase. Even if you can point to me an increase of 1%, I will eat the humble pie and withdraw my bill.
Sam George speaking to Ed Butler. And in the latest episode of Business Daily, Ed looks at what consequences the anti-LGBT bill has had on foreign investment in Ghana. There have been warnings that the bill could threaten Ghana's much-needed donor funding from places like the World Bank and the IMF. Search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now, Australia is a migration nation. A third of its population was born abroad, and it prides itself on its multiculturalism. But there's a big exception. Disabled people are those with medical conditions. The rules are so strict that many foreigners with disabilities or medical conditions are routinely denied an Australian visa. And those already living in Australia face the threat of being made to leave. But campaigners are pressuring ministers to do better and hoping for change, as our Australia correspondent Katie Watson now reports from Perth in Western Australia.
Oh, good shot!
Yeah. Yay!
He's only just learnt to walk, but 2-year-old Luca is already kicking a ball like a pro. Born in Australia, this is home. Mum Laura and Dad Dante moved here from Scotland 8 years ago for jobs that Australia desperately needs. Laura's a nursery teacher, Dante a painter-decorator. But the life they've built here could be pulled from them in an instant. Luca was born with cystic fibrosis. Australia says because of that, they can't stay here permanently. He's a burden.
I think I cried for like a week. I just feel really, really sorry for him. Like, he's just a defenceless 2.5-year-old and, you know, he just doesn't deserve to be discriminated in that way.
Whoa! Hi, Sky!
The sticking point is Luca's treatment. Australia says it would cost around $1.3 million. The family are now appealing against the decision. If they lose, they'll have to leave the country.
It's like, we're here for you when you need us, but, you know, when the roles are reversed and we need you, it's like, nope, sorry, cost too much money, away you go back to your own country, even though we've lived and paid into your country for the last 8 years. It's just a bit heartbreaking.
You're driving the rhino along the beach and sometimes, you know, you've got to pinch yourself and realise you're getting paid to do it, you know.
Australia's actively looking for migrant workers to fill skills gaps. Police forces across the country want British officers to sign up. Their promotional videos show officers on beach patrols in sand buggies and living the dream. They make up just some of the 30,000 Brits who moved to Australia last year.
Are you having butter?
No.
No butter?
No butter.
Claire Day is hoping to be one of them. She's worked for London's Metropolitan Police for 21 years. She has two job offers, one from Queensland's Police Service and another from South Australia. But even if they want her, she won't get in. Her younger daughter, Darcy, has Down syndrome.
I had hoped that it wouldn't be an issue because she doesn't have any medical problems. She's fit and she's healthy. It's a bit bittersweet, really, because the likelihood of me being granted a visa is pretty much zero.
The issue facing migrants with disabilities or chronic medical conditions is this. It doesn't matter if you were born here, how long you've lived here, if you have private health insurance, or even if you can pay for the support yourself. If your health and welfare costs could exceed $86,000 over a maximum of 10 years, that's around $60,000, you fail the medical requirement. While you can apply for a waiver and appeal, not all visas give you that option. It's a lengthy and expensive process, and there's still no guarantee it will be granted. In 2019, the UN warned Australia its policies could be discriminating against disabled migrants and their families.
Yorkshire lass Barbara Porritt, the millionth new citizen to enter Australia since the war, is welcome to Melbourne.
Australia's got form when it comes to strict and historically racist immigration policies. In 1901, Australia introduced the Immigration Restriction Act. That kick-started a period which limited non-white immigrants moving to Australia, policies that lasted until the 1970s. Immigration lawyer Jan Gothard explained.
Most people think of the White Australia policy or immigration restriction in terms of people of colour, and those racist provisions have been removed. The Racial Discrimination Act meant, in theory, the end to racial discrimination, but the Disability Discrimination Act did not get rid of the disability and health discriminations which were set up in 1901.
The Immigration Minister wouldn't give us an interview. Their department did say, though, the government was reviewing the health requirements.
Katie Watson reporting from Perth. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Hull and the producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.
We're in the El Garbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We're in the El Garbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.